Welcome to Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and this show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. We have the most fantastic show lined up for you this week. And I know I always say that, but I got to tell you, this show is different to our regular fare because this week we bring you five author interviews. We've got a non-fiction interview on Freud. We've got fiction, where we're interviewing Nikki Greenwell on her debut novel called A Short Life. We've got an interview on belonging, and we have an interview with one of Nelson Mandela's doctors, Dr. Peter Friedland, on his quiet time with the president. We also have an interview with Frankie Murray about this year's Open Book Festival, which is taking place right here in Cape Town. So five interviews and two reviews, and I'm not going to waste any more of your time talking about it. We're going to dive right into this jam-packed show. First up, with one of those reviews I mentioned, we welcome Shirley Guler to the show. She's reviewing a book called The Prophet and the Idiot by Jonas Jonasson. Now, this is my kind of novel. In fact, it's next up on my pile. I'm getting it back from Shirley Guler now that she's finished it, and I'm going to read it next. It's a light, fun, entertaining read, and I just love this author. Welcome to the show, Shirley Guler.
What starts out as a small and insignificant series of revenge actions becomes a hugely satisfying romp across Europe. The Prophet and the Idiot, the people of the title, end up in part on the tiny island republic of the Condors and its capital, Monrovi, in the Indian Ocean. Full disclosure, any comparison with Comoros and its capital, Moroni, and the fact that the Comoros is number 162 of 180 countries on the scale of corruption where zero is honest must surely be coincidental. The president of the Condors must rate as number 180 if people were measured there. The whole book, which I read on a rainy, cold winter Sunday, putting away, far away, any work, walks, and chores, was, well, just a laugh-out-loud hoot. Jonas Jonasson and the translator, Rachel Wilson Braylers, have turned this romp from Sweden to Italy, Africa, Malta, and then America by The Prophet, the Idiot, and a 75-year-old purple-haired social media influencer into an escapade of fun. What makes an idiot? 200 driving lessons and your hun still can't drive? The fact that he doesn't know the difference between continent and incontinence? That he asks Obama what he does? And what makes The Prophet? Someone with so firm a belief in her own calculations that the world would come to an end in 12 days, yet she was so insecure, she wanted to exact revenge on her high school thwarted love before the world did come to an end? And what about the influencer? A sorry life, which turned the corner when her husband died, and Agnes found the internet, reinvented herself as a 20-something Instagrammer, and found brands rushing to her side, her perceived and photoshopped other alter. Alter ego. Was this fraudulent? Well, Jonasson has such a smart way of writing, and he revels in the menus he draws up for the idiot to cook. In an RV, hotel kitchen, presidential palace, in fact, anywhere at any time, like the master chef he really is. You can savor each of five courses of superb dishes, just one of which is washed down with three shades of white. See what I mean? Human rights as though humans had rights. At least Petra the Prophet honestly thought that, come doomsday, everyone would finally be equal. Equally dead, that is. It's surreal, unreal, totally real, bizarrely real, and yet really over the top. There are encounters with President Obama which almost could have happened. The Russians are there from the days of yore, presidents, thugs, presidential thugs, and the mafia. People are invented, fathers revealed, brothers exposed, identities created, nepotism rules. I kept on hoping that the idiot will turn out to be a brain box and live happily ever after. And in a way they all do, fraud and swindles aside. Long may they continue to live happily, if the world doesn't come to an abrupt end soon, that is.
Thank you so much, Shirley. As I suspected, right up my alley, I can't wait to read this one. Next up, we pivot and we go to a slightly more serious topic and we turn to nonfiction. Beverly Ruiz Miller is here with one review, but in this review, she's chatting about Knife by Salman Rushdie, and she's contrasting that book with another book called The Soft Vengeance of a Freedom Fighter, which is by Albie Sachs. Both of these names I'm sure you recognize. These are huge, big-name authors, and this is a thoughtful and thought-provoking review on these two icons and the similarities in the trauma and horrific violence they've both endured, and how they've explored this in their writing. Welcome to the show, Beverly Ruiz Miller.
Two well-known men are publicly and violently attacked and barely survive death. These are hate crimes against the ideas they hold. Both men almost miraculously live, writing memorable books about their difficult recovery and continue to thrive despite their permanent injuries. Knife is by Salman Rushdie, one of the most recognizable names in literature, who was attacked on the stage in the United States 2 years ago by a young knife-wielding fanatic, years after the fatwa was no longer thought to be an imminent threat to him. Much earlier, The Soft Vengeance of a Freedom Fighter was written by South Africa's Albie Sachs, lawyer, writer, academic, and later Concord judge, an anti-apartheid activist who was car-bombed in Maputo in 1988. His strikingly frank book, translated often, records his rescue and slow recovery and eventual triumph in life. A natural peacemaker, his soft vengeance would be the freedom he had always sought for this country's people. And it is told with modesty and humor, too. He was already known in the world of literature and arts for his earlier Jail Diary, translated into a play performed by the Royal Shakespeare Company. Rather oddly, some of both men's permanent injuries were quite similar. Both lost their left eye and the use of a hand. In Albie Sachs's case, most of his right arm. Rushdie's writing hand has partially recovered. One of his doctors said it was luck that the young fanatic didn't know how to use a knife to kill. Both men felt euphoric once they knew they would live, but the road ahead was tough and security remained an issue. Rushdie deliberately uses language as a knife in his book, a tool that would cut open the event. To write would be his way of owning what had happened, refusing to be a victim, to answer violence with art. So did Albie Sachs. Yet this is where the two books begin to diverge. Rushdie decided not to meet his attacker, or indeed even mention his name in the book, yet it's easily available on the internet. His decision to withhold information from the reader, including fans such as myself, is made even stranger by his baffling decision to include a long imaginary monologue with him, which Rushdie uses as a sort of pulpit to expand his own worldview and ideals. It felt too demagogic, thumping his own cleverly conceived worldviews onto this invisible protagonist, even though I often agreed with him. The section doesn't work. It is the opposite of openness, of how to excavate, to understand, if not share, the path that had led Hadi Matar to his manic knifing of an aging writer. Another rather distracting note in Rushdie's book is that he also uses it as an extended love song to his fifth wife, Eliza. That's heartwarming and obviously important to him, but less useful when examining a public atrocity. Where these two books really intersect is in their motivation. Rushdie writes, "This is bigger than just me. It's about a larger subject." Yet Knife isn't bigger than Rushdie. In it, he is seen always as the giant of literature, imbued with privilege and his closeness with some of the greatest writers of the era. The striking cover of Knife is worth mentioning, but for me this is not Rushdie's finest book, despite his desire to turn calamity into art. You will have to decide which book speaks to you on the most personal level, for both are intimate as well as public records, and both books should be in every library in the country.
Is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter there. You can forget all your troubles, forget all your cares. So go downtown, things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure. Downtown, everything's waiting for you. Downtown, don't hang around and let your problems surround you. There are movie shows downtown. Maybe you know some little places to go to where you never close. Downtown, just listen to the rhythm of the gentle bossing over. You'll be dancing with them soon before the night is over. Happy again. The lights are much brighter there. You can forget all your troubles, forget all your cares. So go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure. Downtown, everything's waiting for you. Help and understand you, someone who is just like you, who needs a gentle hand to guide you along. So maybe I'll see you there. We can forget all our troubles, forget all our cares. So go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure.
That was Downtown by Louise Howlett and Albert Combrink, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and this show is sponsored by Exclusive Books, and all our music for the show is compiled by Mzuma Keita. We go straight into another interview. Now this one, Vanessa Levenstein took a look at the revised standard edition of the complete psychological works of Sigmund Freud. The original translation was by James Strachey. This has been revised, supplemented now, and edited by Mark Solms. So Mark Solms is known for the integration of contemporary neuroscience with psychoanalytic methods and theories. He's also known for his discovery of the four brain mechanisms of dreaming. I'm so fascinated by dreaming. He is the director of neuropsychology at the University of Cape Town and Groote Schuur. He's the science director of the American Psychoanalytic Association, and he's the co-chair of the International Neuropsychoanalysis Society. So how he found the time to edit the revised standard edition of the complete psychological works of Sigmund Freud is beyond me. It's very impressive. And how he found the time to be interviewed by Vanessa is also beyond me. Welcome to the show, Vanessa Levenstein, and welcome to the show, Mark Solms, and I guess welcome to the show, Sigmund Freud.
The long-awaited revised standard edition of the complete psychological works of Sigmund Freud, original translation by James Strachey, has been revised, supplemented, and edited by Mark Solms. We're so delighted to have him on Book Choice. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
The project started 30 years ago, 24 volumes later. How does it feel to have completed this mammoth task?
It's an enormous relief, but I have to tell you, when I took on this task in 1994, literally, as you say, 30 years ago, I had no idea it was going to take me this long. So I'm not sure how enthusiastic I would have been if I had known what I was letting myself in for, and therefore now I feel nothing but relief.
How did it affect your psyche being so closely bound up with this material for so long?
You know, I had, if you'll excuse the way I put it, many conversations with Freud over the last 30 years, because what you have to do in order to translate somebody is you have to read every single word and sentence that they write, and then try to clarify in your own mind, what is this guy trying to say here? You know, what is the idea behind this sentence? What is the idea that's cloaked in these words? And then try to convey that idea in your own language. So I feel that I really have gotten to know Freud and understand Freud if I may say so, better than anyone. I really think I do understand Freud better than anyone.
I'm sure you do, which leads me to my next question. If you had a hotline to him, what would you ask him if you could quickly phone him up and say, Siggy, just quickly tell me what you meant by that?
I think if it had to be a quick conversation, I would tell him about those things that modern science has led us to different conclusions from his own. You know, there are a few things that I think are questionable in Freud's theories in the light of modern findings. And I'd like to know what he thinks about those findings and if he would revise his ideas on those points.
You became very close to Freud. So were there times you wanted to tweak him slightly to make him more palatable to people or change his ideas sort of secretly without telling anyone?
Yeah, that's a very serious temptation. It starts with rather subtle matters like, you know, the points that he makes not entirely clearly where I felt, if I could just reword this, you know, I could make the point that I think he's trying to make here in a slightly clearer way than he makes it in the German. And of course, you have to resist that temptation because your job as a translator is not to improve on what the person has written, but rather to faithfully convey it, you know, in the language you're translating into. But there were more concrete instances of that kind where Freud used words which to the modern ear are offensive. And I emphasize to the modern ear because Freud in his own time was an extremely progressive and enlightened guy. But still, you know, 100-odd years later, many of these words, they don't land well. So the kinds of things that I have in mind is when he speaks of indigenous people in Africa and in Australasia and so on, he speaks of primitive people. Mm. So those days, that was the kind of word you would use. But of course, you know, people are in one culture are no more primitive than people in another culture. So it kind of really jars. Mm. But you have to translate what Freud wrote. He said primitive, you know, so that's what you've got to say. It's unsettling, but there's nothing to be done about it.
Well, presumably people will read it in the context of the time.
Yes. I made a little footnote here and there to that effect, saying, you know, acknowledging that, of course, these terms are offensive, but in Freud's day, that's how people spoke.
Father of Psychoanalysis has received both reverence and rejection. With your addition, do you think he'll be received with more understanding now and seen exactly as we've been discussing in the context of his times, as the genius he was?
I think that let me just be clear. For our listeners, although what we are talking about is a translation of Freud's complete psychological works, it's not only a translation. There's also an editorial apparatus that comes with the translations, by which I mean I write an introduction to each paper and I add footnotes in square brackets, so it's clear that it's me speaking rather than Freud. And in those footnotes, I explain things and clarify things and make cross-references and point out that this idea is followed up there and this idea evolves and changes later, you know, and so it does help the reader to get a clearer sense of it. Also, the original translation of Freud's works into English was done in parallel, much of it, you know, with Freud's writing in German. Many of his works were translated as they came out. But the original standard edition, in other words, the collected edition of all of his works, came out in the 1950s and 1960s. So there's been an enormous amount of scholarship and scientific research since then, which I've been able to draw upon. And also, I was able to speak a more modern sort of English. So, I mean, people might have forgotten, or I suppose many of our listeners are so young as to not forget it, but never knew it in the first place. Those days in the 50s, when you say, for example, today, it was a hyphenated word, to hyphen day. Mm-hmm. You know? And even the word psychoanalysis was hyphenated, psycho hyphen analysis. So I think it's more accessible, more readable to the modern eye.
It was very readable. And I want to go back to the subject of our readers. You write about the masterly quality of Freud's prose, and your aim is to make it readable, which you do. Will this book come out in paperback to make it more affordable and more accessible? Obviously, it will come out in Kindle if it's not out already, but very few people are going to be able to afford the hard copy.
Yes. There are a couple of things that will happen that will make it more affordable and accessible. The first is, as you've just alluded to by reference to Kindle, there is an electronic edition, and that's coming out right now, so in parallel with the print edition. So the electronic edition obviously is cheaper than the print edition. It also doesn't take up a whole shelf, a whole bookcase. But in addition, there will be a paperback set that's in the pipeline. And furthermore, it will become possible to buy individual volumes.
Brilliant.
Currently, you can only buy the complete 24-volume set. So you have to, you know, lay out the full whack all in one go. But shortly, it'll be possible to buy it volume by volume. And so as budget allows, so you can buy it, slowly collect up the whole set.
And you'd want to get the final volume, which has all the footnotes in, presumably. So you'd want to get the last volume first. And then build it up.
That volume is my pride and joy. It's, it's the most sort of technical and scholarly volume. As you say, it has all sorts of footnotes. But it also has very interesting discussions of how I went about translating these terms, because there's no one-to-one mapping of one language onto another. You know, something's always lost in translation. So I try to convey to the readers what is lost, what the subtle differences are between the technical vocabulary in English and the technical terms that Freud used in German.
You've done an incredible job. Thank you so much for your time and all the very best.
Great pleasure, and thanks for your interest.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. I have to tell you that getting to look at these books was a really big deal. It's not just one book. This is a whole series of books. Vanessa went into the publisher's office, and they were kind enough to bring out all the books for her so she could actually look at them and touch them and smell them and feel them. And then they gave her the digital copies, which she read what she could of them to prepare for this interview. So I know that a lot went into this interview on the part of the publisher and also on the part of Vanessa. I'm so grateful for your time, and I'm so glad you've delved into this. It's fascinating. We're going to pivot again for our next interview and change direction completely. We're going into light, beautiful, light, thrilling fiction. Nikki Greenwell, another name you will have heard in South Africa, has brought out a debut novel. I've mentioned it before on the show because I read it and I really enjoyed it. It's a thrilling read. It's set right here in Cape Town, so you'll recognize a lot of the twists and the bends of the roads that she drives on. And it's called A Short Life. Welcome to the show, Beryl Eichenberger. And hello, Nikki Greenwell. Congratulations on the launch of A Short Life.
Producer, entertainment journalist, and former television presenter Nikki Greenwell has added another string to her bow, that of novelist. Her debut book, A Short Life, is an unsettling tale of six friends whose lives are forever changed by two accidents on the same night. It sits in the genre of domestic noir, in the familiar setting of Cape Town, and the road to the truth is as curving and surprising as the road where the accidents occurred. A very warm welcome, Nikki.
Hello, it's very good to be here.
You're on the other side of the microphone.
I know,
now.
It's weird.
It must be. So you are a journalist, you are a woman of many talents, but what made you want to write a novel?
Well, it's an interesting one, really. The main job that I did when I was on television was that of producer. So some people recognize me from television as a TV presenter, but
right.
the main job that I did was being a producer. And you'll know yourself, being a producer, you're responsible for the money, getting the money, allocating the money, buying the stuff, hiring the staff, and making sure that you can then recoup the money. So it's a lot of people, it's very expensive, and I had just done a massive documentary project that was 10 episodes, 1 hour each. It was long,
wow.
It was stressful.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't sure if I was going to get the money back. It was horrible. But it worked out in the end, but I felt after that experience, I just wanted to be alone and create something by myself,
right,
without spending any money, without hiring any crews, and there was some sort of appeal to that being alone in the creative
having
process.
Having space.
Yes, and there was no low stakes, if that
yes.
makes, you know.
Yes.
And so that was really what drew me to, I mean, I've always wanted to do it, but the timing just felt right. It was like a pendulum swing between that heavy intensity and then something a bit more freeing.
So they say write about what you know, and I know that you did some courses. But do you want to just elaborate very quickly on the courses that you did just for our listeners as well?
Yes, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of your listeners who might be considering being a novelist. And really, I wrote a book in 2020 that was rejected by everyone I sent it to.
Which definitely is not this one.
No, well, I've come to realize that writing a book is a bit like getting a tattoo. You're stuck with it for a while.
And it's painful.
You're right. I'm glad that one was rejected because it spurred me on to join these courses at Curtis Brown Creative, and I honestly can't recommend them enough. They're just online courses. They're not too expensive. They're quite short, and you work with a group of 15 peers from all over the world.
Terrific.
Critting your work, you crit theirs. It's like a forum structure, and it was amazing. And the things I learned on that course helped me to develop this book.
What inspired the story? I know when I was looking at a video for Penguin Random House, you said it's a lot about you. I mean, yes, it's about privileged characters. Sorry, we have to say that. But
yes.
You create an incredible atmosphere. It's very dark and edgy. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of guilt, a lot of secrets, a lot of surprises. Was it from an actual incident that happened to you, or how did it develop?
No, it's...
Do you want to give it a quick synopsis as well?
Well, okay, so the story is about a group of friends who come into conflict when one of them dies suddenly and in mysterious circumstances. And it's really about two car accidents, and the reader is encouraged to work out if one accident had something to do with the other, because they both take place on the same night on the same road. And really, it was I read this book by Rooman Alam in 2020 called Leave the World Behind, and they made a Netflix series out of it, or a movie out of it, with Julia Roberts. The movie for me wasn't as good as the book, as is usually the case, but that book really inspired me because it was a thriller, really defied all genre, but it was very pacey, very quick, but it also had like a philosophical message. And I wanted to, after I read his book, I thought this is a story that I need to tell. So it is personal in the sense that I've experienced grief. I've experienced loss. I have lost people in car accidents. I have lost people to cancer, as many people would the age that I am now. Death is unavoidable. And so it is a little bit of a response to that. But at the same time, it's not meant to be this depressing. It's positive.
It's certainly not depressing. It was dark. There were some sinister undertones that I really enjoyed, I must say. And I thought that your characterization was very sharp.
Oh, thank you.
It's
a huge compliment.
You've got the six friends. Mm-hmm. They're all quite different. I mean, Charlie and Frankie, who are best friends, and Frankie is very neurotic.
Yes. I have experience with that.
Was she based on someone you knew?
Yes, she might have been. Neuroses, guilt, fear. Fear, to come back to the title, really, is none of us know how long our lives are going to be, and we can't control the length of our lives or the length of the lives of the people we love. So the central conundrum in the book is really, you know, you can love a partner, a parent, a friend, a child. Mm-hmm. You can love all these people simultaneously, but what happens when the people you love prove not to be on the same side? And it's really an exploration of that, because I like the idea of these triangular relationships we all find ourselves in.
Mm-hmm.
A classic example of that is a mother-in-law. You know, you love your partner. Do you love his mother?
His mother.
And would you do anything for her? And that's kind of what it's about. Or if you have a friend and they have a husband, are you as loyal to the husband as you would be to your friend, because your friend would be loyal? And we all have those kind of relationships in our lives. And I really wanted to explore that through the characters.
I think you've answered what I was going to ask you, which is, what did you want the reader to take from it?
Well, no, I mean, the thing that I say to people, I'm sure you read the bit about memento mori in the book. So for anyone who doesn't know what a memento mori is, it's a positive reminder that we're all going to die, but it's not meant as morbid. It's meant so that you can live your life more fully.
Yes.
And that's a theme in the book. So I hope that the book itself can be a memento mori, so that once you've read it, and people have said to me that they read it and made them want to live more in the now.
Yes.
Because they understood that things can happen really quickly. And if we just spend our lives worrying about it, that's not a useful thing to do with our time. But I also wanted to say, did you know that this radio station is actually in the book? Dun, dun, dun. I remember this morning while I was driving here is that...
Yes, you're listening.
Yes, on I said I was listening to the classic station to stop the character from getting anxiety attacks while she's driving.
Right.
And that was you guys. So
thank you.
You are actually in the book,
Nikki, thank you so much. I wish we had longer. The book is A Short Life by Nikki Greenwall. It's published by Penguin Random House. It's out now. It's great. I think you will love it. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Was Pococa by Titania Thale and Dimitrios Giannakis, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your bookie host, Paige Nick, and our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. Believe it or not, we go to another interview now. Today we're joined by Alison Weher, who's a former political activist. She's a serial entrepreneur. She's a philanthropist. She's a woman of stature, awards nominee, and she's a thought leader in identity intelligence. And now, beyond all those things, she is also the author of a new book called Belonging. She's going to be interviewed chatting about her book by Kim Vermaak. Kim is a new voice on the show. She is also an author. She's a book coach. So if you have a book out there that needs some coaching, you know where to turn. She's also a publisher, and she's known as the Mindset Whisperer for Legacy Authors. She also has a YouTube channel, which is called Write, Learn, and Earn. So that's something worth checking out if you're an author or a potential author. So Alison Weher's Belonging is about coming home to love. It's about acceptance and inspiration. This deeply personal account is of a journey of self-discovery and personal growth. It tells of the emotional and physical transformation of a sensitive child who never felt enough. Take it away, Kim Vermaak.
There's no doubt about it, South Africa is shifting. And with that, our identity is shifting. Places that we thought we belonged in, that's all changed. And along with it, our identity. But behind politics, there are people, vulnerable people, going through things. And so that's why I am so thrilled to have our guest today, Alison Weher, because Alison Weher is an author that pulls back the veil of what's really happening in the hearts of South Africans. Alison, welcome.
Thank you, Kim.
You have seen some remarkable things in your time on the planet, from being a political activist, being an entrepreneur, going through your own shifts, dealing with family issues, mental health issues that many, many South Africans and people globally are suffering with. Tell us why you decided to write this book, Belonging, at this time.
Kim, it took me 13 years to have the courage to write this book. And I had to write this book when I had been fully healed, when I could truly reflect on this really quite unusual journey that I'd walked. And it was writing this book that made sense of my entire life. And I could have gone to my grave without ever telling my story, but something in my heart said, maybe this story can help somebody else feel less alone and understand the journey of belonging. But what I didn't realize was the incredible timing that aligned with the release of the book, that the book came out at a seminal time in the history of our country with the new government of national unity. And having come from being steeped in the ANC as a political activist and as a trade unionist, working directly under the president at one stage and various other quite remarkable leaders, I walked a journey of then becoming an entrepreneur. And then I was on the other side of the boardroom table for 25 years. dealing with trade unions. So I think I've had an interesting journey, but I didn't feel quite comfortable to tell my story before. And it was really global storytellers that unlocked a voice and whispered to me that maybe I did have a story to tell and that maybe my story could help other people. But I didn't realize it would be so multi-layered. And I think that's been the deeper journey of belonging, diving beneath the layers of the personal relationships over the years and the personal transitions. And what led me to become a political activist was a number of series of pivotal awakenings in my life. And so I document that with great reverence, because it was all of those buses and all of those journeys that allowed me to sit here today as a speaker and a writer, as somebody who could reflect back on the meaning of this journey.
Now, it's quite interesting that there were certain things that happened in your life that perhaps we thought from a demographic perspective you wouldn't have experienced. But in the book, you do speak about your car being bombed, getting onto a bus that was segregated that you were not meant to be on, and also dealing with the humanity of people that were going through the whole struggle with apartheid. That left a mark on you. How has that changed the way that you relate to the world at the moment?
I think all of those journeys shaped me to become the person I am. And I saw things that I could not unsee. And that's been my journey. And I think that's what I write about from a deeply vulnerable perspective. Because it was those moments, those very human moments, that shaped me. And working in impoverished areas in Cape Town for 7 years, in the sandy back streets of Khayelitsha and Mitchell's Plain, and working with the National Union of Mine Workers here in Johannesburg, all of those shaped me and greatly humbled me to understand just what a privileged life I had had and just the daily struggles of so many people in this country. And so I hope the book is a deeper reflection of that. And I hope that my book can be a voice of unifying, of moving from identity politics to understanding the human journey of how we can live in hope, that we can find voices that rebuild this country after 30 years of a long and convoluted road to reach this pivotal point in time.
Well, Alison, I have to say that as a book coach and author myself, I thoroughly enjoyed reading the book. And I want to offer the audience an opportunity of knowing how to find the book. So where is the book going to be available?
The book is going to be available in Exclusive Books and other aligned bookstores.
Thank you, Alison, so much for being on the show. This is Kim from Mark, and I'd like to thank the listeners for being part of our journey. And I will see you at Exclusive Books in Cape Town for our next function.
Thank you, Kim. And thank you for all you've done to make this remarkable journey possible.
Right, we have two more interviews left. We're going to jump now to Philip Todras. This is a very interesting interview. We have a doctor in the house. This book is a doctor's story about learning to listen. After many years of serving the country and doing his part to help rebuild South Africa, Dr. Peter Friedland was given an opportunity to serve as a member of Nelson Mandela's medical team. And he helped to monitor Nelson Mandela's hearing. He's brought out a book now called Quiet Time with the President. And he met Philip Todras in the Fine Music Radio studios to chat about it. Hello, Dr. Peter Friedland.
I'm talking to Dr. Peter Friedland, who wrote the book Quiet Time with the President, a doctor's story about learning to listen. Seeing you don't have a copy of the book in front of you, I must say that the president we're talking about is Nelson Mandela. The book is also written in association with Jill Margo, but we can talk about all those personal details. But I will start, Peter, if I may call you Peter, not Dr. Peter.
Of course, please.
Is termed a leading ear, nose and throat surgeon in Australia, but most of his career was spent in South Africa, where he was head of ENT at the Wits University Donald Gordon Medical Center, and is written in association with Jill Margo, his sister, who's a best-selling author specializing in biography and in Australia. But the thing that came across to me is one very personal account. You became his personal physician for many years. And I'm just going to quote from your book, and I think we need the story to come from there. My memory of those last years is misted in sadness. I think of the multi-layered decisions he'd had to make in his life, and that he had so much time locked away from loved ones and then no time to repair his neglected relationships. While being swept up by the greater good was glorious and politically fulfilling, it was also emotionally impoverishing. Peter, I think, you know, you've gone through your life as well, and I think maybe that was something that motivated you to get your life in perspective after that particular relationship you made with him, not only professionally, but emotionally.
Well, absolutely. And Philip, thank you for this wonderful opportunity and speak with you and your listeners on Fine Radio. You know, I felt, what must life have been like isolated in prison for 27 years, away from family, chit-chatter at the dinner table, children growing up, grandchildren, and then coming out of prison and being confronted with the responsibilities of negotiations and running a country, and not being able to connect with your family that you have had no connection, physical connection or emotional connection in a real sense for 27 years. And that experience was framed by my own experience of, you know, undeserved white privilege and growing up witnessing apartheid from a very privileged white perspective and dealing with my own dilemmas and my own crises when friends of mine were shot and killed and I was exposed to violence. And I always contrasted it to what Madiba had gone through in his life. And although it sounds quite grandiose, in a sense, you know, he sacrificed his entire life and his family and his children for the struggle and for the beautiful country that South Africa became. And in a sense, I was doing the opposite. I was sacrificing my country for my children. And that always stayed with me.
But when you met him as well and you told him that you were going to Australia, I gather that there was, or should we make readers find out about this from reading the book, but there was a very personal wish that he said it was on one condition.
Yes, and he, you know, even though I'd known him for almost a decade, and I knew that he was forgiving, he never forgot, but he was forgiving and he was non-judgmental. I was absolutely terrified to go and see him and broach him on the subject. This was the most difficult decision that I had made. It's not a decision I didn't want to make. And my family didn't want to leave. We were very committed to the country. But I had snapped. I developed post-traumatic stress syndrome and I just couldn't cope. And instead of castigating me and criticizing me, he gave me a lesson of a fundamental mistake that he had made. That was the humility of the individual. And he said to me, "Doctor, don't think you're so clever. I made a terrible mistake out of ignorance. And if you don't make this mistake and you follow what I tell you, then I will give you permission." And I'll leave that up to your readers to read that chapter. But Madiba taught me how to listen. You know, this was no, I had the unique opportunity, it was a gift, that I had access to him when very few people had access to him. And many books have been written, including by Madiba himself and his family, about the early years, the presidential years. But very little has been written about the twilight of his life, you know, the winter of his life.
And the fact that you brought hearing into
Yes, the discussion, being hearing impaired
is an issue and people need to address it.
And Madiba was so proud about his hearing loss. He wanted it to be known. He wanted people to know that he had a hearing loss and that we should do something about it. And when I engaged with him, he was no old man, sentimental, rocking in his chair by the fireside. He was engaged. He was present. He was very principled, and he taught me the lesson of listening. He would listen, and then very slowly he would respond. And when I mean listening, you can hear people. But as doctors, we often interrupt them very quickly. You've got, an American study said you've got 11 seconds
before a doctor interrupts you. We don't have that many seconds left
ourselves. What Madiba did was that he encouraged me to listen to people's history and the emotions behind their story, the people and the country behind it. And that changed me.
Well, I think the importance to me of reading your book is to go through the various chapters of your life. And I think in a way you might have reassessed them in terms of this very special relationship you had. And even now dealing with yourself and the loss of hearing and that we're talking about the physical condition as opposed to the emotional condition, which, you know, there's been that adaptation, which I think he's been a remarkable person, not only in the field of politics, but in the field of human relationships, in making us understand, adapting, and as you said, even in negotiations, being able to hear the other person. So we've been speaking to Professor Peter Friedland, who made a life for himself abroad, and thank him and Jill Margo for creating a book which is certainly very valuable lessons in who we are, where we are going, and the decisions we have to make in life. The book is published by Jonathan Ball, and I would highly recommend it.
Che bella cosa, naiurinate sole, n'aria serena, dopo la tempesta.
That was O Sole Mio by the Afro Tenors. And finally, we come to our last interview for the show. Nancy Richards is joining us now. She's a name you'll definitely recognize, and she's a voice you'll definitely recognize. Nancy Richards is an icon of radio broadcasting in South Africa. She's also an author. Her book is called The Skipper's Daughter. She's joining us today to chat to Frankie Murray about the Open Book Festival. I'm a huge fan of the Open Book Festival. It happens in Cape Town every year. It's one of my favorite book festivals. It helps that it's in my hood. And I also love the Book Lounge. It's hosted by the Book Lounge, which is easily South Africa's favorite independent bookstore. Welcome to the show, Frankie Murray. Let's hear all about the Open Book Festival.
An author herself, Frankie Murray, has been in books for a very long time. She's been the coordinator of Cape Town's literary duel, the Book Lounge's Open Book Festival, for a good few of those years, taking a short break to turn a page or two, only to come right back again to an even stronger festival. Well, the festival, the Open Book Festival, began in 2011. Like everything else, took a bit of a dive around COVID. So we're all very thrilled, all of us in Cape Town, very thrilled that it's back on the calendar with its four core goals. But before we get into the core and content of the OBF, Frankie's own book, Everyone Dies, was launched at the festival last year, and I can't imagine that it's the last we'll be seeing of her between the covers, so to speak. Frankie, lovely to have you here. And
always just, good to chat to you.
Just quickly, tell us, are you, I mean, it always feels like jinxing. Have you got something that you're writing right now?
I'm always writing. It's a compulsion, a habit, but one that I enjoy immensely. I am writing with a little bit more intent, strangely. I think that's probably because of the experience of publishing. And I do hope that Karina, my publisher of the previous one, will accept another one from me.
Oh, well, this sounds like a much longer story that we'll get into another day. I love it. I'm always writing. That's got to be a great line. But I imagine as you're in your role as program coordinator, you're always reading.
Yes.
Do you have to read up a storm for this festival?
Yeah, of course. I think that you can't do this job if you don't love reading. I think anything in the book trade, because it's quite a tough industry to survive in, you've got to be in it for the love. And I certainly, like, I've been reading since I was about 3 years old. I've consumed anything that I can get my hands on. I read, like, quite eclectically. But obviously with the festival, my reading has shifted quite significantly so that the focus is, by and large, South African work, which is immensely exciting. We've got some unbelievably talented people. not just the established names, but these new, fresh voices that come with such exciting content, original, insightful ways of examining our country, our past, our future. This year, I'm just thinking about Siya Kumalo. His novel, The Queer Book of Revelation, has, I think, just hit shelves. It's a sci-fi, mind-bending travel, like time-traveling search for like queerness in the past. I mean, it is so good. I mean, Sia is just lovely anyway. Mm. And his previous book, You Have to Be Gay to Know God, was also fantastic. And this is, like, I was in no way prepared to shift from what I'd read of his before to this. Anyway, I'm going on about Sia.
I love it because what's interesting, what you said there, is that, well, a couple of things. Not only that we're growing writing, but we're growing new readers because with this diversity of writers, we're growing new potential
Absolutely.
Readers. But also, I like what you've said about Sia, is that he's a really nice person. And one of the things about the festival is that you don't just get to read the books, you get to meet the person behind the book.
Yeah, I mean, like, to me, it's an absolute privilege to curate the program. But we have never really thought of the events that we curate as being the festival itself. Those are like the kind of starting points. It's something that we can pull people together to celebrate. But it's actually the generosity of spirit that the authors themselves arrive with and the audience. This coming together of people who are just really excited to be in a safe, welcoming, inclusive space that reflects Cape Town. And
having been to several of them, it's the coffee connections. The people putting their hand up in the audience to ask questions. It's
yes.
the chat afterwards. It's a huge networking of the situation.
Yeah, and I mean, like, the vibe in the foyer, it just gets, like, you know, that you don't want to leave. And watching people coming out of events with these smiles on their faces or talking animatedly to each other as they're leaving, it's just remarkable.
So, as if you haven't done enough, tempt us a little bit further, because I think the core goals of the festival, to attract top writers and audience, showcase best of South African writing, to make a significant, sustainable contribution to our future by building a love of reading, hallelujah, drawing representative audiences to all open book events. So those are your core goals. But what are the trends? It started in 2011, 13 years, lucky for some, later. What are the current trends? What are the authors that you're going to be showcasing? What are they writing about?
You know, I think that if you look at the world that we're in and South Africa specifically, there are certain things that we have to reflect. So there's always going to be examinations of masculinity, for instance, and how that can be shifted away from the toxic. There's always going to be the content around mental health.
Mental health is a huge
exactly.
one. Exactly. Many issues confronting South Africa right now. Very sadly, frankly, we've run out of time, but I think the program is out there live.
Yes.
www.openbookfestival.co.za.
And you can also reach me, frankie@openbookfestival.co.za. I'm always happy to respond to an
and
email.
And can I say hurry now while stocks last, because I know that they
yes.
get booked up very quickly.
Yeah,
Frankie
please.
Murray, bless you. Good luck. Break a leg.
Thank you.
I felt like that interview just went by far too fast, so I want to add my voice to the conversation and tell you a little bit more about the Open Book Festival from my perspective. First of all, I can tell you that tickets cost either 30 Rand or 50 Rand, and there are also some free sessions. And there's something for everyone in this festival. There are kids' books, adult books, fiction, non-fiction. It's a little bit like this show. We feature all kinds of writing for all kinds of tastes. They also have workshops and panels. I highly recommend that you go take a look at their catalogue online and see what they've got coming up. I had a little look through and I wanted to share a couple of sessions that might grab your fancy just to whet your appetite and send you to the Open Book website. The first one I wanted to tell you about is called Libraries Growing Authors. Now, this is a free panel. It's on the 7th of September, 2. And it says here, join a selection of the winners and librarians involved in the Cape Town Libraries 2024 writing competition to hear more about their writing journeys. I love a librarian. In fact, I think librarians should run countries. Imagine how smoothly our country would run if we had librarians at the helm. So that was a panel that caught my attention. Another panel that caught my attention, this one is called Love and Other Toxins, and this is on the 7th of September at 4 o'clock, and tickets for this panel are 50 Rand. So one of my favorite authors in South Africa, Sven Axelrod, another one of my favorite authors, Shabnam Khan, another one of my favorite authors, Alex Latimer, all speak to Dela Gwala about the many faces of love. I can guarantee you this is going to be fascinating panel. Tickets are 50 Rand. Hurry and get your ticket, although don't hurry so fast. I need to get my tickets first. I'm telling you, tickets to these festivals, they sell out super fast. So if anything I'm talking about interests you, go and grab your ticket as soon as you can. The next one that caught my eye is a Khoi language workshop. This is free. It's on the 8th of September at 10 o'clock. And the blurb says, join Taroga Denver for a basic introduction to the Khoi Khoi clicks, counting, and greetings. Fascinating. I'm sold. Sign me up. I think even though it's free, I think you still have to go onto the website and book your ticket. As I said, they sell out fast. And then the last one I wanted to tell you about before we wrap up the show is called the Letterhead Literary Quiz. This is a 30 Rand entrance. It's on the 8th of September at 2. Who doesn't love a literary quiz? They invite you to a quiz about all things bookish, characters, first and last lines of books, crossovers in culture, and more. So assemble your team of up to 6 people. Come on, show your skills and secure bragging rights and prizes. An afternoon of fun and competitive quizzing. So you can win 500 Rand book vouchers for the book lounge. But remember, tickets are limited to 6 per purchase, and they're only going to have 6 teams. So if you're interested in that, get your tickets as fast as you can. Right, so that wraps up our show. I've run out of time. I could carry on chatting about this forever. I want to thank Mzu Makheta for compiling all the music for today's show. I want to thank Exclusive Books for sponsoring the show. We're so grateful. And I want to thank all the authors, all the reviewers, and all the publishers for giving us these beautiful books and taking the time to come and join us today. We're going to play out with Tenderoso by Tony Cox. And until next time, happy reading.